My name is Alexander Armstrong. I have the immense pleasure and honour of being the president of the P.G. Wodehouse Society UK. If, like me, you try to bring a little joy and laughter to each day, there is no better way than a generous helping of one of England's greatest writers and whimsical humorists, Sir Pelham Grenville Wodehouse, or Plum, as he was known to friends and family. P.G. Wodehouse died 50 years ago on Valentine's Day, a day that celebrates love, happiness and romance, around which many of his novels, in fact, are based. He himself enjoyed a long and very happy marriage to his beloved Ethel. They wed in 1914, when she was a young war widow and the mother of a small child, Leonora. Plum started married life, therefore, with a ready-made family. He adored his stepdaughter and, in fact, went on legally to adopt her. Many Wodehouse characters also happily knew love. Even the otherworldly Lord Emsworth loved his beloved prize-winning Berkshire sow, the Empress of Blandings, probably more than any other living creature. But Plum's most famous character, Bertie Wooster, managed to avoid the occasionally harmonious state of marriage, ably helped by his equally famous valet, Jeeves, who was firm in his belief that marriage was not a good thing for his employer. This was perhaps because it would have reduced Jeeves to the sidelines in terms of influence, but we mustn't be unkind. Although Bertie often pursued love, often with hilarious consequences, it never quite pursued him enough to catch him. He was engaged many, many times, occasionally to more than one girl at once. One of his more unlikely candidates for marriage was the intellectual author Florence Cray, who thought she could make something of Bertie, something that Jeeves thought should be avoided at all costs. Another false start was the dreamy Madeline Bassett, a rather dippy, albeit attractive, young lady who thought that the stars were God's daisy chains. Both women were deemed most unsuitable by Bertie's ever-watchful, ever, it must be said, correct, Jeeves, who fought tooth and nail, discreetly, of course, to protect his young master from marriage. But that didn't stop Bertie from stepping in occasionally to help good friends to pursue true love. In one of my favourite Wodehouse novels, Righto Jeeves, the shy and hapless Gussie Finknottle has fallen head over heels for that very selfsame Madeline Bassett. He tells Bertie how he met her one day out walking her dog in the woods near his home. The dog had got a thorn in his foot, and she was unable to remove it. Gussie stepped in and valiantly extracted it. It was love at first sight for him. But, as he tells Bertie, he lacks the courage to plight his troth to Madeline. So Bertie offers to play Cupid and pave the way for Gussie. In this edited passage from chapter 10, Bertie explains that things don't run exactly to plan, especially as the rather dreamy Madeline gets the wrong end of the stick when he invites her for an evening stroll in the Rose Garden at a weekend house party at Brinkley Court. That's the home of Bertie's favourite aunt, Dahlia. So, whatever you're doing, take a few minutes to sit back, or stand back, and enjoy the good-natured humour of those times, as Bertie steps in as matchmaker extraordinaire in Righto Jeeves. How different it all would have been, I could not help reflect, if this girl had been the sort of girl one chirps to over the telephone and takes for spins in the old two-seater. In that case, I would have simply said, listen, and she would have said, what? And I would have said, you know Gussie Finknottle, and she would have said, yes, and I would have said, he loves you. And she would have said either, what, that mutt? Thank heaven for one good laugh today. Or else, in more passionate vein, hot dog, tell me more. I mean to say the whole thing would have been over and done in under a minute. But with the Bassett, something less snappy and a good deal more glutinous was obviously indicated. What with all the daylight saving stuff, we had hit the open spaces at a moment when the twilight had not yet begun to cheese it in favour of the shades of night. There was a fag end of sunset still functioning. Stars were beginning to peep out, bats were fooling around, the garden was full of the aroma of those niffy white flowers which only start to put in their heavy work at the end of the day. In short, the glimmering landscape was fading, and all the air had a solemn stillness, and it was plain that this was having the worst effect on her. Her eyes were enlarged, and her whole map a good deal too suggestive of the soul's awakening for comfort. Her aspect was that of a girl who was expecting something fairly fruity from Bertram. In these cirques, conversation inevitably flagged a bit, and the talk hung fire. I'm never at my best when the situation seems to call for a certain soupiness. It had been all very well for me to promise Gussie that I would cut loose to this girl about aching hearts, but you want a cue for that sort of thing. She finally spoke. "Oh, look," she said. She was a confirmed oh-looker. I'd noticed this in Cannes. "Oh, look at that little star up there, all by itself." I saw the one she meant, a little chap operating in a detached sort of way, above a spinny. "Yes," I said. "I wonder if it feels lonely." "No, I shouldn't think so." "A fairy must have been crying." "Eh?" "Don't you remember every time a fairy sheds a tear, a wee star is born in the Milky Way? Have you ever thought of that, Mr. Worcester?"
I never had. However, I was in no mood to dissect and criticise. I saw that I'd been wrong in supposing mention of the stars and fairies crying were not germane to the issue. Quite a decent cue they'd provided, and I leapt on it promptly. Talking of shedding tears, but she was now on the subject of rabbits, several of which were messing about in the park to our right.
"Oh, look, the little bunnies."
"Talking of shedding tears,
don't you love this time of evening, Mr. Worcester? When I was a child, I used to think the bunnies were gnomes, and if I held my breath and stayed quite still, I would see the Fairy Queen."
Indicating with a reserved gesture that this was just the sort of loony thing I should have expected from her as a child, I returned to the point. "Talking of shedding tears," I said firmly, "it may interest you to know that there is an aching heart in Brinkley Court." This held her. She unshipped a sigh that sounded like the wind going out of a rubber duck.
"Ah, yes. Life is very sad, isn't it?"
"Well, it is for some people. This aching heart, for instance."
"Those wistful eyes, drenched irises, and all through a foolish understanding about a shark. What a tragedy misunderstandings are. That pretty romance broken and over just because Mr. Glossop would insist it was a flatfish."
I saw that she had got the wires crossed. "I'm not talking about my cousin Angela."
"Who then? Mrs. Travers's?"
The exquisite code of politeness of the Worcesters prevented me clipping her one on the earhole, but I would have given a shilling to be able to do so. There seemed to be something deliberately fat-headed in the way she persisted in missing the gist.
"No, not Angela's mother. Dash it, you know why hearts ache."
She seemed to shimmer a bit. Her voice went all whispery.
"You mean for love?"
"Absolutely right on the bullseye. I take it you believe in love at first sight. That's what happened to this aching heart."
"Oh, I do, Mr. Worcester."
From the tone in her voice, I could see I'd got her going. "For you, I mean." I decided to put in the fancy touches. "I dare say you've noticed on these occasions that the difficulty is to plant the main idea. The rest is mere detail work. I don't say I became glib, but a dashed sight glibber than I had been. This heart is having the dickens of a time. Can't eat, can't sleep, all for love of you. And what makes it all so rotten is that it, this aching heart, can't bring itself to tell you." I heard her give a gulp. I saw the eyes become moistish, drenched irises, if you care to put it that way.
"Please don't say any more, Mr. Worcester."
"I wasn't going to."
"I understand."
I was glad to hear this.
"Yes, I understand. I won't be so silly as to pretend not to know what you mean. I suspected this in Cannes, when you used to stand and stare at me without speaking a word, but with volumes in your eyes."
If Angela's shark had bitten me in the leg, I couldn't have leapt more convulsively. So tensely had I been concentrating on Gussie's interests that it hadn't crossed my mind that another unfortunate construction could be placed on my words. I mean to say, if a girl thinks a man is proposing to her, he can't explain she's got hold of the wrong end of the stick and back out. But the thought of being engaged to a girl who talks about fairies being born because stars blow their noses frankly appalled me.
"Yes, all those days at Cannes, and how you followed me down here with that same dumb, yearning look in your eyes. A girl always knows. Then you were so insistent I come out and walk with you in the twilight."
As she was carrying on with her remarks, I listened with clenched fists till I shouldn't wonder if my knuckles couldn't stand it and were white under the strain. Then it seemed my guardian angel had not been asleep after all.
"But I'm sorry."
The word was just like one of Jeeves's pick-me-ups.
"But I'm afraid it is impossible."
She paused.
impossible," she repeated.
I had been so busy feeling saved from the scaffold that I didn't get it for one moment that an early reply from yours truly was required.
"Oh, righto," I said hastily.
"I'm sorry."
"Quite all right."
"Sorrier than I can say. We can still be friends."
"Oh, rather." We went on like this for some time, to-ing and fro-ing with promises of friendship and all that, when I suddenly divined she wanted to get something off her chest.
"You mean there's someone else?"
She nodded.
"You're in love with some other bloke?"
She nodded.
"Engaged, what?"
"No, not engaged."
Well, that was something. But from the way it looked, poor old Gussie might well have to scratch his name off the entry list, and I didn't like the prospect of telling him. He was unlike my other pals, like Bingo Little, who, if turned down by a girl, would toddle off to find another. Gussie was a bird who, having failed at his first chucker, would turn the thing up and spend the rest of his life brooding. As I paused in thought about poor Gussie brooding alone with his newts, I became aware that Madeline was still talking.
"I'm afraid he doesn't care for me. At least he's said nothing. I'm only telling you this because we're friends."
"Oh, rather."
"And you asked if I believe in love at first sight."
She closed her eyes and continued.
"It's a silly story. I was staying with some friends in the country. I'd gone for a walk with my dog, and the poor wee mite got a nasty thorn in his little foot and couldn't get it out. And then suddenly this wonderful man came along."
Suddenly the agony through which I had just passed all seemed worth it. I realized she must be referring to Gussie. I mean, there couldn't have been a platoon of men taking thorns out of her dog that day. A positive thrill permeated the frame, and there escaped from my lips a wow so crisp and hearty that the basset leapt a liberal inch and a half from terra firma.
"I beg your pardon," she said.
"Oh, nothing," I said. And just then I saw Gussie sidling out from behind a tree. "Mustache, just remembered a letter I have to write. Here comes Gussie Finknottle. He'll look after you." Seemed to me everything was beyond question absolutely in order. All Gussie had to do was keep his head down and not press. There didn't seem more for me to do but start pricing fish slices. She loves him, he loves her. I left them alone in the twilight to begin their happy ending and legged it back to the house. I had earned my 2 penn'orth worth of wassail.